Coming up on the Seeking Computer Hardware, Google Stadia streaming gaming still needs work. 10,000 series Intel CPU rumors. Neon Noir is a beautiful benchmark. Field kits cool. Valve announces Half-Life Alyx. It might be the flagship for Oculus VR. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Podcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 542, recorded on November 21st, 2019. Google Stadia? Meh. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by iFixit. If you're tired of dealing with the ball and chain charger on your laptop, switch the battery yourself. iFixit makes it easy to swap the battery out on your Mac or PC with their all-in-one battery fix kits. Just visit iFixit.com/Twitch and you'll get $10 off your next $50 fix. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch Weekly Show that aims to bring you a whole lot of hardware news, and oh my goodness, do we have an exciting update today that has both Sebastian Peake and I just weeping with excitement, practically panting with enthusiasm, and I am incredibly, incredibly exaggerating here because Sebastian's, if you're watching the video, nonplussed would be a gracious term for the facial expression on that man's face, because we're talking about the final launch of Google Stadia, which the crew over at The Verge say, quote, it feels like a beta. It works, right? It seems to have a better picture than most of the streaming gaming services we've seen in the last several years. What's crazy, as The Verge notes in their review, is just how much is missing or not working particularly well. 4K doesn't look 4K. A lot of the features we expected are somewhere in the it'll be launched eventually kind of mode, which I think in some ways plays into sort of a long-standing tradition of gaming where you would remember when you would buy a box at the store and then turn around and download, you know, all of the code that should have been the box over again because they actually finished the game in between when they printed the boxes and the CDs and sent them out to all of the GameStops.
The worst trend of all time. Yes, I remember that. The box with nothing in it but a code. So I don't know. So you can fill up your shelf with codes.
Yeah, I mean, Sean Hollister did the review up at The Verge, and you know, we're going to lean a bit on his review for no small reason other than he's actually been hands-on with just about all these systems that have launched for out forever. You know, he also very bluntly states, despite the charm and an improved slate of games, Google's cloud gaming service isn't anywhere near what the company initially promised in March. It's effectively a beta that Google is charging real money for, and you should wait until 2020 for that to change. You know, it's not going to work over LTE. It will seamlessly transition over Wi-Fi between a PC and a phone. By all counts, the video looks better than some of the rivals that came out in the previous years. You know, it's $130 plus $10 a month after a 3-month trial. Then you pay $20 to $60 per game. And it's kind of brutal, right? You know, there's 22 games, most of which you can already get somewhere else. You know, you need a Chromecast Ultra dongle for 4K and HDR, except 4K doesn't look very good. You know, the Stadia controller only works wirelessly with Chromecast. You know, you can use Google Pixel phones at 1080p, but you need a controller clip, and you need to plug it in with USB-C. It seems incredibly messy. In fact, none of these features were actually testable by reviewers. Although, quote, Google claims they'll work on day one. Look at all those USB-C cables connecting all those controllers. So in 2020, right, Stadia becomes Stadia becomes free. Then you pay for games. How are you feeling about this, Sebastian? You're very quiet over there.
Yeah, we don't have any hands-on yet because we're not alone. My managing editor, Jim, had pre-ordered it. He doesn't have his code yet. I saw another outlet was kind of complaining on Twitter that they didn't have their code and they were on hold for forever and basically being told that it's being rolled out. They might have to wait. And right. So, you know, we don't have any firsthand experience with it. What I've read about it is pretty much as you were saying, that this seems like a test. It's not a polished product by any means. And if you look into the technical side of things, which is where I've been investigating, you know, we heard early on that this was going to be based on roughly a Radeon Vega 56 GPU, X number of cores of a CPU and the equivalent of about a Radeon 56, a Vega 56. And mm-hmm. I have been inundated with Google Stadia advertising on YouTube, and it's 4K gaming is this big push of theirs. And it's just, okay, if I had dedicated desktop equipment in front of me and I had a Vega 56, I would certainly not be playing at 4K. That is not a 4K gaming card. In fact, you could make the argument that there is no single GPU that will provide an excellent gaming experience at high detail settings at 4K across the board yet. Not even an RTX 2080 Ti playing Red Dead Redemption 2 4K, highest settings, 60 frames per second. It's just not going to happen. So the fact that they're advertising this led me to kind of question how this was even going to be possible. And of course, I saw a story from 9to5 Google where they had quoted both Eurogamer and The Verge, and The Verge had talked to the Destiny developers, Bungie, about their game at 4K, which is apparently actually only rendered at 1080 and then upscaled. So that's Stadia 4K for Destiny 2. That's a 1080 game being upscaled for you. And then Eurogamer had done some investigation, and they found that Red Dead Redemption 2 is actually being rendered at approximately 1440 and then upscaled to 4K for the 4K version. So they're having to resort to the same sort of thing that we talked about earlier this year that NVIDIA was doing with the technology called DLSS, where on the front end, they were talking about how it was using AI and deep learning to upscale and enhance the game. And what was happening on the back end was they were rendering the game at a much lower resolution. So that's where the performance boost was coming from. They were not transparent about the fact that it was being upscaled from a low resolution. And that's why we saw complaints about clarity, complaints about sharpness. And it's the same thing all over again. If you read the rather scathing 9to5 Google article where they flat out call Google liars about the 4K advertising, they are just citing these other sources, and there's links to all that stuff where you can see where Digital Foundry did their investigation and where The Verge talked to the developers. And yeah, it's lower res. So I feel like that had to happen. There's no way with the concerns already about bandwidth, that kind of makes sense. And what I mean by bandwidth is it's over 100 megabytes a minute to play games on this thing at 1080. So depending on what your situation is with your provider, I personally don't have a data cap. I don't know what the policies with Charter Spectrum here in Michigan are as far as a threshold, because some of them have soft caps where you actually have your speed reduced past a certain threshold. I'll have to investigate that. But it's not even necessarily available here. My managing editor who did order it, he did the speed test online. You don't have to have the controller or anything. You just need to use a Chrome browser, do their speed test. He said he qualified, but he's kind of on the fringe as far as what his performance is going to be like. So I don't know. I thought about this at the beginning as this is something that Google could pack in with their Google Fiber and say, hey, you have a Google Fiber connection. Now why don't you stream all the latest games in high resolution? And they could make the decision, being the ISP in that case, not to cap your data or to exempt Stadia from your data caps if you did have one. And maybe they could control the experience better and give you lower latencies. Because even though I'm sure anybody who has reviewed this early is using the special secret sauce Stadia controller, which
well, they have to,
which provides negative latency, I think is how they actually phrased it, which may or may not be preemptively inputting controls that they expect you to make. Even with that controller, if you look at the Eurogamer article or anybody who's actually measured latency, Eurogamer uses high speed photography. you're still adding 40 to 50 or more milliseconds of latency compared to, say, an Xbox. So I find it curious that if for people who want to play games, who
right.
want to play all the latest games, and who don't necessarily want to either build or buy and maintain a gaming desktop PC, I get it, or a big expensive laptop gaming PC. I totally get that. And that's what consoles are for. I thought consoles filled that need, because for $300 to $400, you can buy yourself a console that will play everything. And it's an appliance at that point, and it connects to the internet. You can download all the games on day one, and you can play with your friends. And there's a significantly lower latency and better gameplay experience with an Xbox One S than there is with Stadia. And then if you buy the game, you own the game, even though it's, you know, if you're buying it digitally, you only, you know, own
mostly.
It.
Mostly.
Or as long as they provide it to you with your account. But I feel like this is an interesting idea, but I don't know why the console suddenly has been abandoned at this point, because we don't need it. We don't need dedicated hardware. We just need to stream it over a tablet or a phone.
Right.
And maybe someday that will be the case. Maybe in 5 years, people will remember when we use dedicated hardware for gaming, but I kind of doubt it, because graphics keep getting better.
Right.
Resolutions keep getting higher. 4K is becoming far more commonplace and far more affordable in the gaming space. And there's 5K stuff out there. There's going to be 8K stuff that will be coming down in price. And at what point will the ultimate gaming setup not be some sort of ultra wide, like 36-inch wraparound monitor with the equivalent of like an extra wide version of 4K? And we don't even have the graphics yet to drive 4K across the board at high settings. And as the new GPUs come out, it's just going to put more and more of a strain on anybody who's providing a streaming service. If games are programmed to take advantage of the latest hardware, then I just wonder what is Google's upgrade path here? If they're using a Vega 56 equivalent, are they prepared to seamlessly transition to Navi? Why didn't they wait for Navi? If the latest consoles that are coming out next year are going to have the Zen 2 architecture for the CPU and Navi for the GPU, why did they rush this out with whatever the current Skylake-based Intel CPU cores and an aging Vega architecture for? I have a lot of questions, and I feel like there needs to be a little bit more transparency about the technical side of it, though. You know, we find things out. We find stuff out through like Vulkan driver support, and apparently it takes Eurogamer using high speed photography to find out what the latencies are going to be, because of course that is going to vary from person to person. But I just find it interesting, like the resolution thing kind of tipped the scales for me. It's like, okay, it's not even 4K. And I see 4K on every ad. So I'll stop ranting about this.
No. I mean, it's not just you don't see 4K, you don't see 1080p either. That was one of the things that came out of that Verge article, where they talked to one of the game developers, and they're like, yeah, it's not 4K. It's 1080p, and, you know, we apply blah, 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 and the 1080p is 720p, and we apply blah, 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 blah. And you know, this is, you know, there's a moment when you're dealing with certain situations. Like, I remember a printer manufacturer, and, you know, they were trying to convince me that their profoundly lower resolution inkjet printers did a better job than, you know, inkjet printers that had like twice the resolution. And this was in this was years ago, and the difference was pretty massive. You know, we're not talking about the difference between an 18 megapixel and a 26 megapixel camera. We're talking about the difference between like a megapixel and an 8 or 10 megapixel camera, like huge differences in the size of the dots of ink and how many you had per inch. And, you know, they were basically like, well, our superior smearing technology gives us an equivalent, blah, blah, blah. And I, you know, gave them a file and they printed it out on their printer that they brought for the demo, and I grabbed a copy of the print from a comparably priced printer from their competitor. And, you know, they looked at what was a smeared mess that was low resolution, and they were like, you know, as far as we're concerned, this is just as good with fewer pixels. And I'm like, wow, you're opening, you know, like, you're either blind or openly lying to my face. And, you know, right now you have game developers going like, because game developers don't care where they sell their game. You know, they would like another path for game sales. But, you know, they're honest. They've been honest with the reviewers. And it's disingenuous for you know, Google to be like, oh, yes, it's 4K. Well, it's 1080p, you know, poorly up-resed. That's not acceptable. So, yeah. We'll both stop ranting now.
I just hope that they receive. I feel like Google's a big company, obviously, and there's a lot of outlets that cover Google and that don't necessarily want to piss Google off. But I hope that people are as harsh on them for this as they were with NVIDIA with DLSS, because DLSS had about as negative of publicity as you'll see in the PC gaming space outside of other debacles such as the infamous 3.5 gigabytes memory thing with the GTX 900 series. I think it was, what was it, the 970? Like, just silly stuff like that, where because they weren't upfront about it, it became a mess. And when they weren't upfront about the DLSS upscaling, they just said it was using deep learning to create a better super sampling effect. It was called deep learning super sampling, which makes it sound like it's a replacement for AA. And that's how they sold it. Like, instead of regular anti-aliasing that just softens the image. And this was explained to us at CES. Anybody there at their booth was being shown side by side the Port Royal benchmark, which is a real-time ray tracing benchmark from 3DMark. And they were saying, look on the left, and that's it, you know, running on the same graphics card, but with DLSS enabled, and it's running at a higher frame rate. And because of deep learning, we're able to go through and find the edges of objects and keep the edges sharp, but then apply the anti-aliasing just to the parts that you're not going to notice aren't as sharp. Like, that sounds amazing. I left that room at CES saying, this is great. This is the best application of AI I've seen in gaming yet. And I can't believe how good this looks and why the frame rate was like 20 frames per second higher on the same graphics card. And then, of course, you think about it, and then some more technical things come out, and then there was a white paper, and you're reading about Port Royal and how the DLSS effect works. And so I was actually watching, one screen was 1080, and the other one was only 720 up-res to 1080, and that's why frame rate.
And that's why this is so fast.
Yeah, that's why it's so fast. And of course, they were only showing stuff in motion, and when it's in motion, you get away with having a lower resolution. And if you actually look at screenshots side by side, you start to see huge differences in sharpness, and that's what we've seen with Stadia. Look at some Stadia versus Xbox One X screenshots. Those are interesting. One of them looks like you smeared Vaseline all over your monitor. The other one looks really sharp. So,
ouch.
Yeah.
This is a man that's not afraid to piss off Google PR.
They'll send me stuff.
You know. Or Alphabet Stadia PR, whatever we're calling it now. But I thought it was interesting because around the same time we see them, you know, being awkward. I won't say they're lying. Perhaps they're just delusional or they've smeared Vaseline over their contact lenses. But, you know, at the same time, Ars Technica is reporting that Google is paying up to $1.5 million for the most severe Android exploits. And as Dan Gooden summarizes at Ars Technica, quote, big bump coincides with investments Google has poured into securing its Pixel phone. And that's seven times what they were offering in terms of rewards before. So if you're not too familiar with security professionals and bug bounties, you know, not too long ago, it's kind of an open secret that there are researchers who are maybe a little gray hat or maybe a little black hat, who will cheerfully sell zero-day exploits or unknown exploits or you know, basically you know, secure, they will sell information about security hacks. Some of these have been sold to the U.S. federal government, to the NSA and other agencies. Some of them are sold privately to people who want to take advantage of them, the security exploits, to make money or to do terrible, terrible things before they are discovered and the flaws patched. You know, the big one on this is a $1 million bounty, quote, for a full chain remote code execution exploit with persistence which compromises the Titan M secure element on Pixel devices. They'll pay $500,000 for exploits that get data out of a Pixel or get around its lock screen. So, you know, they offer like a 50% bonus on the rewards if the exploit, quote, works on specific developer preview versions of Android. So a Titan M, quote, I'm going to quote, you know, Ars Technica, I'm going to quote Dan Gooden here. You know, a critical Titan M hack on a developer preview could fetch $1.5 million, and a data exfiltration or lock screen bypass on a developer preview could earn $750,000, and so on. And in the past, the max was like $200,000, and only if they involved the trusted execution environment. So this is all about sort of securing the Pixel, making sure the Titan M, the Google chip inside the Pixel, is secure. This is kind of a big deal, you know. And, you know, quote, the new rewards come almost 3 months after third-party exploit broker Zerodium started paying $2.5 million for zero-day attacks compromising Android, which is a lot more money than you get for a similar iOS hack. And this is interesting. So I just wanted to note that. There seems also to be some sort of changing in the battlegrounds over keeping phones secure, which I think is a pretty good concept. I'm down with that because it's not like Google doesn't have the delete expletive money. Maybe they even have the delete expletive money to render their games on Stadia in 4K, but we promised we would let that go.
Oh, no more of that. No more of that, Patrick. Next year, they'll be on NVIDIA GPUs with a DLSS. That's the solution.
With a cable, with a USB-C cable. If you have an Oculus Quest, the wired VR Oculus Link cable, the Oculus Link is live. The cables, I believe, are shipping now, or maybe they're still missing. But essentially, the Quest can connect via USB-C 3 cable to a PC and run the you know, Oculus Links or the Oculus games that you might want. And it's cool. It's a nice expansion of the kind of capabilities of the Oculus Quest to make it a wired PC VR headset. Interesting thing, you know, is that NVIDIA is good to go on this, and AMD just doesn't work, at least not at launch. You know, Facebook/Oculus says that high-end AMD cards will be supported eventually. So, and the other thing is you know, older desktop NVIDIA GPUs, and for example, like GTX 1060s on laptops aren't going to work. But it'll be curious to see what's going on, because the other thing we're hearing is that the rendering pipeline is going to make a wired Quest, quote, look blurrier than on native PC headsets. So it's a perk, not a replacement. If you have an Oculus Quest, keep an eye out for the Oculus Link cable availability, and that'll give you access to the desktop Oculus games. So not dead yet, although pretty much all of the founders and chief people have kind of wandered off on that. So, hold on. Wait a minute. Oh, sorry. I thought we had an actual link to an Oculus cable. So.
Yeah, it's still bleeding edge enough that you're going to have to spend quite a bit on a graphics card if you already have one.
Yeah, I mean, you need a decent graphics card. And it is any USB 3 cable that's up to their specs. So.
Yeah.
Not that USB 3 cables are always the easiest thing to find without ordering things online. but it's good. Yeah, the official Oculus Link headset cable is still coming soon, in case you're wondering. Yeah, 3.2 Gen 1 Type-C, a right-angle USB Type-C for the headset, and a straight Type-C for the PC. So, yeah, if you also just keep that in mind. I don't know. I feel like I can't decide if we're kind of on a – I don't know. It just feels like we're kind of in a lull on the whole VR market, which is kind of frustrating.
Okay, we'll talk about something that might change your mind in a little bit. I put something on the dock.
What's going on with Comet Lake S desktop lineup getting leaked? Is it good? Well, yeah, is it exciting?
It is exciting for consumers because I know we talked about – I'm still waiting on these price drops, by the way, because I've heard things like – you know, the stock price is expected to go up with these price drops. Like, what price drops? We saw the announced price drops for the ninth generation desktop stuff, where the recommended pricing of a part like the i5-9400F, if I'm getting the letter right, that used to have a recommended customer price of like 184. We've seen it selling consistently for about 140, 145, and it's dropped to as low as 129 on sale. That customer price went down by about $20. So we would expect that to translate into lower retail pricing. And it was the same across the board, $20, $25 off of these desktop processors. But maybe that makes more sense when you consider that they might be refreshing the entire lineup with 10th generation parts. But of course, these are still going to be on the 14 nanometer process. So just as we saw with them rounding out their laptop offerings with 14 nanometer parts that needed to hit those higher clocks and have higher core counts, the higher wattage parts that are found in high-end workstations, that sort of thing. Apparently, according to the Inquirer, Intel's entire lineup of 10th generation Comet Lake desktop processors appears to have leaked. And what's interesting is that it's basically higher core counts across the board. And they're adding hyper-threading to the Core i5 processors. So that means a 6-core Core i5, which is the current standard for 8th and 9th gen, that will go up to 6 cores and 12 threads. They're up to that 5-digit numbering system that we saw with the previously announced high-end parts. So it's the Core i5 10,500.
Ooh.
And then like the Core i3 10100. So now we're into binary code, it looks like. The i3 10100 is a 65-watt part. That'll be 4 cores and 8 threads. So even the Core i3 has hyper-threading. So if this is correct, we're going to see desktop parts that are now going to be up to, what's the high one? Is it 10 cores? The Core i9 10900K, if this is accurate, will be a 10-core, 20-thread part. So if that takes the place of the 9900K in the lineup, it'd be somewhere in that $450 to $500 range. Now you're talking about a 10-core part. So they clearly have felt some pressure from AMD with the Ryzen launch. Ryzen 9 3900X is a $500 12-core, 24-thread part. And if they come out with a 10-core part and they can show, hey, here's our, you know, if they have similar performance because maybe they're hitting higher clock speeds and they have some IPC advantages, then they could have a compelling argument that, hey, we're just as good as Ryzen 9. But I'm sure that's not going to be their messaging. Their messaging will be, we are the leader. We have the highest gaming performance. Now we have a 10-core part for the same price. And it's good for anybody, especially if you're already on that platform and you have envy of the high core counts over on the AMD side and don't necessarily want to switch platforms right now. That could be a great drop-in update. But, of course, I don't know if it will be a drop-in update. Will this work on Z370 and 390 boards? Will it require a new Z490, 470? We shall see.
So, basically, it's a waiting game.
Right, because it's just a rumor. It's a leak. And actually, there was another leak. I didn't write about this, but somebody posted a link to Intel's own support site, and it was a PDF of the new 10th generation Nook, their small next unit of computing, little mini PC kits, and their 14 nanometer. So I was going through the specs, looking them up, like, oh, okay, it's the same thing again. The ninth or the eighth gen Nook is the current high end. And the big disappointment to me about that is not that it doesn't have enough processing power. A Core i7 Nook is a perfectly acceptable desktop productivity machine and a very good, like, small home theater or server. But it doesn't, well, on the home theater side, the problem is it doesn't have a great graphics chip, and it certainly doesn't really have any legitimate gaming capabilities. And then it doesn't have some of the added features that their 10 nanometer architecture brings to the table, such as the Gen 11 graphics, which are a huge leap forward. You'd be basically getting the equivalent of one of AMD's Ryzen APUs in an Intel Nook, that level of performance that we just haven't seen from Intel before. But we're going to have to keep waiting. So hopefully at some point in 2020, we get that Nook that has the faster graphics. But it looks like across the board, Intel has kind of had to take a step back and refresh their products with a new generation number that is still using the same architecture as we've seen for, what, the last few years now. They're still on the Skylake derivatives at this point.
And so we wait.
Yeah. AMD, they're, by releasing Ryzen when they did, by being really aggressive with it on what I consider to be an immature platform with X570, which is just now with its latest microcode updates, the AGESA 1.0.0.4 revision B, that's pretty much like release. This is release ready. It was pretty much ready for release at 1003 ABBA, the last one. But it certainly was kind of in that pre-release stage when it first hit. We were getting, I had an ASRock board that had 5 BIOS updates in July. That's how frequently AMD was pushing out new microcode for these processors. So clearly that platform was not mature.
And that's pretty aggressive.
It's very aggressive. And by the way, ASRock, ASRock, the motherboard vendor, it's one of the big four that you'll see if you shop for motherboards. In our testing, in our experience, they've been the most aggressive about pushing out motherboard BIOS updates, although Gigabyte gives them a run for their money. It seems like between Gigabyte and ASRock, you've got the latest microcode before the other vendors even have it available. So if you're on the bleeding edge, there's a good platform. And for us to be testing, we get stuff really fast on those. But just that was a prime example. When was the last time you bought a new system platform? Like you bought into a new CPU socket, bought a motherboard, and had a half dozen BIOS updates in the first month. It just seems insane.
Well, it seemed like I waited several weeks for the updates that I desperately needed when Ryzen launched, but that was also
That first generation Ryzen
kind of different place. So
all right, and there was a lot of those were like memory compatibility and adding things to the qualified vendor lists and just tweaking stuff. But these are updates that change processor behavior, change the boost duration, change the conditions of boost, change the voltage of the processor. So it's just like they were trying to figure out how to get the most out of these parts and manage temperatures and, you know, they're maybe even addressing some longevity concerns. We don't know. That was something that it seemed like Intel was kind of feeding out there to some outlets. So we don't know. We're not going to know if these things have any kind of long-term issues until we've waited the number of years, but it doesn't seem like that's the case. And they seem to have gotten about as much as they can out of them with these last two updates. So it's not really affecting performance as much as those initial BIOS updates did, but just something to consider.
I don't know. I just always hope that they're not releasing all of these updates because of things they've broken on various platforms or various vendors. But
There was that whole Red Dead Redemption 2 thing, but then there was so much finger pointing. I still don't have a clear picture of who was actually at fault there. And then
I don't think anybody does.
Yeah, they patched it, and now I think I have that in the list. We'll talk about that.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by the crew at iFixit. We love iFixit because they make it easy to replace the battery on your Mac or your PC yourself with their all-in-one fix kits. If your laptop or your phone is a few years old, it probably needs a new battery. It's probably time. because you use a battery, capacity goes down, and it's a thing, people. You wear batteries out if you use them all the time, and you probably use your phone and your laptop all the time. What's cool about their all-in-one fix kits, you get everything you need. Parts, batteries, tools, everything you need is in the box, and it's backed by an industry-leading warranty. You get the most helpful repair guides on the internet, and you get them for free. It doesn't matter if you're fixing a screen or a motherboard or a washing machine. All the repair guides that I fix it are free. Seriously, they can help with more than just your phone or your laptop. Step-by-step instructions with amazing photos let you see how easy it is to do it yourself. You can get the help you need repairing game consoles like the PlayStation, the Xbox, the Nintendo, Kindle, iPad, Windows, tablets, Mac and PC computers, cameras. They got just about all the major brands in there. Even if you're thinking, I really want to fix my car or my truck, from the battery to the sun visor, even your brake pads, they have guides for you. They even have guides to fix appliances and apparel. We've talked about iFixit for years on This Week in Computer Hardware. Even before they became a sponsor, we were using their tools. I mean, let's see. I'm looking around. I can see a lamp, an iPad, a refrigerator. Well, it helped me install the refrigerator. It didn't help me fix the refrigerator, so we can say maybe on that one. Man, the number of things I've used the tools for my iFixit to repair is kind of large and growing, especially because I have children and children occasionally break things. I know that's a shock to those of you out there. Oh, wait, yeah, the kids use the iFixit Pro Toolkit to repair their drones pretty regularly. It's good stuff. Yeah. Look, iFixit, they can help you fix just about anything. Check out their all-in-one fix kits at iFixit.com/Twitch, and you'll get $10 off your next $50 fix. That's iFixit.com/TWICH. We want to thank iFixit for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. And do yourself a favor, head over to iFixit.com/Twitch. Get yourself a discount on your next fix, people. It's a good thing. I like iFixit. There's a lot of nice people that work over there.
Yeah. I bought an iFixit kit. They offer, I think they still offer this. It was a kit to add a second hard drive to your Mac Mini. And the Mac Mini, when it still had a 2.5-inch hard drive, this was a 2012 model. I bought this kit. It came in this nice zipper bag. Opened it up. It's got all the stuff I need. And it also had this like clamshell tool kit. It was like miniature screwdriver, all these bits, and a bit like an extender. And that thing, long after the Mac Mini was gone, this has been, what, 7 years now, I still have that little screwdriver kit, and it's always with me, and I've used it to, it's everything from putting batteries in my son's toys to, you know, fixing computers, taking apart laptops, and it pretty much has every bit you're going to need, even to take apart Apple stuff, because it's got like the little Torx bits and stuff in it. So they're pretty good longevity on that, especially considering my son has flung it across the room a couple of times, and it's seen better days, but it's one of the most useful things I've ever bought. And I literally just got it like as an accessory with my Mac Mini install kit at the time.
It's a good thing. It's a good thing. Oh my goodness. Where were we? We were talking about computer hardware, but this actually, you know, I'll let you talk about it.
You were a little bit down on VR.
I'm a little bit down. I'm a little worried about VR.
Yeah.
Is it okay? Does it need to pick me up? Does it need help?
It does need to pick me up. You know what people have been saying? VR needed a flagship. They needed a killer app. That's the term in the industry. It needs a killer app. Like, it needs the Mario 64 that makes you buy the N64 when you see it at Toys R Us, at the kiosk. So, apparently, the Half-Life Alyx that's been sort of pre-announced then teased, and now it's been officially announced as of today, and Half-Life Alyx is coming in March of next year. A number of outlets, including The Verge, have a first look on this. They have some screenshots and video, and it is the next part of the Half-Life story. So it's the same length as Half-Life 2. The Orange Box came out a long time ago, and so since the Orange Box, which, what was that, like 2007 or something, we've had rumors and games in development that were canceled. And now at this point, beyond those episode one and episode two editions that we had that was part of the Orange Box. Episode two came out with the Orange Box. Right. Now you're actually going to have a new full standalone game, and it's a VR game. So I feel like this might be something that can really drive VR sales, VR interest. Mm-hmm. We have a few months to kind of build up that sort of excitement about it. I'm sure there'll be plenty at CES about this as well. I'm sure Oculus will be showing off headsets. Maybe there'll even be a demo of this. I don't know. But it's also interesting. I mean, this is Valve's big play to add some relevance to this. And I mean, if you're watching the video, the graphics are stunning, of course.
Of course.
And if they have a really good, highly optimized, very well integrated VR experience, I'll try it out. This is one of those things where I look at this and I think, okay, this could be the thing that gets me into VR, because so far I've not been terribly impressed with the stuff that's out there, and I don't like dealing with some of the motion issues because I'm very susceptible to that. But if this performs at a really high level on reasonably affordable hardware, then that could be a compelling thing. And of course, we don't know what the GPU landscape is going to look like in the spring and early summer of next year either.
Right.
So just kind of fun to check this out, and especially if you're a fan of the series, to know that there is a full new game coming. And if they're smart, at least for the first, you know, for some period of time, it would be a VR exclusive. I have not heard VR exclusive. I've just heard that it's sort of built from the ground up to be a VR game. That's what Valve is claiming. So that doesn't mean they can't. Yeah, that doesn't mean they can't make it into a PC game with a mouse and a keyboard, but it's definitely a VR-first approach, which is nice, and it's something that it makes things like Office Simulator seem like a toy, which is really what those were. The games like the Nintendo GameCube that you could interact with, this is a different level of immersion. So, if something like what is the 2077 game? Cyberpunk? Am I getting the name right? 2077. If that had been VR first, then maybe that would have driven some more interest. Because, I mean, Keanu Reeves alone. That, look at how much traffic that. Keanu in VR. A Matrix game in VR. Think about this, Patrick. You literally put on the headset and you go into the Matrix.
Yeah. I'm down with it. And, you know, better late than never. That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
Better late than never. Vulcan performance issues with Red Dead Redemption 2. We talked about that. We talked about it again last week, or week four last. Yeah. We talked about it again last week. Apparently, the Vulcan performance issues with NVIDIA cards has been resolved. Did they give any details on that, or were they evasive?
They were very vague. I was looking for release notes, and there wasn't a whole lot. Sean Pelletier from NVIDIA had tweeted this out. I looked at the customer support site, and it was just a very brief hotfix driver update. The note was basically just that it improved Vulcan performance. There was another issue, Tomb Raider crashing in DX12 mode that they fixed. But what was interesting to me about this is the fact that we had talked about some finger pointing with the developers of Red Dead Redemption 2, and then apparently outlets were reporting, and it was on Reddit that users were submitting, you know, if they were on a GISA 1002 on the new Ryzen 3000 CPU, it worked just fine. People in our PC per public Discord chat were saying, yep, I'm on the launch BIOS still, and it works, it opens and runs. And people on different variants of a GISA on AMD Ryzen 3000, it was crashing on startup, so they couldn't even get into the game and play it.
Ouch.
And so there was a game engine update about a week ago now. And now, and the developers had stated that it was issues with graphics drivers, but NVIDIA has come forward and they have this hotfix. So apparently they're addressing some of those Vulkan performance, and the stalling is what they specifically cited. Stalling on some systems with 4 and 6 core CPUs. I hope, and I haven't done testing yet, but I'm going to do testing, and hopefully they have fixed the problem with those unusual frame time spikes that were only in Vulcan, where DX12 was actually running a lot smoother across the board. Normally, you'd think that a Vulcan game optimized for that API would run better in Vulkan. And while frames per second on average were higher, those 99th percentile frames were also higher, which led to less of a, like, the less smooth gameplay experience. So that micro stutter we used to talk about a lot.
Make it all stutter less, people. Field Kit grand prize winner, the 2019 Hackaday prize. This is slick. This is, were you kind of, were you drooling in a nerdly fashion when you read about this on Hackaday.com?
Well, Jeremy, who works, is our like main news writer. He pointed this out last night to us, and he sold it to me as a tricorder. He's like, maybe you can't buy a tricorder,
but
you can make money. And that's kind of what this is. This is just like, if you think about, it's big. And he was saying, well, it's bigger than a tricorder. I'm like, it's bigger than a next generation tricorder. It is not bigger than an original series tricorder. It's actually kind of in between. So if we've already got it to the point where we can put this multi-use, fully functional sensor thing, you can just take out into the field and do various sensing with it. And I don't even pretend to understand everything that it does and what it's capable of, but you can look at the project and see how it's made and what it actually can do. And it's just like a field research data device. So basically a tricorder. And I just thought that was really cool. And of course, this won their $125,000 grand prize.
Nice.
So it already looks like it has a pretty polished design and a pretty polished app, companion app for it. So
that's pretty amazing. I mean, I don't know. I'm excited by it.
I'm still trying to figure out exactly what the sensors can do. And if you've watched the video, you see there's somebody crouching down. They're on the edge of a boat. They're reaching down into this water among the reeds and the lily pads, and they're pointing a
it's
sensor.
It's very biology thing. Kind of experiment.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, if you go to fieldkit.org, you get some amazing graphics on an active web page. And it tells you that FieldKit is coming. Let's everyone everywhere monitor the world around them in low-cost reliable sensors with low-cost reliable sensors and easy-to-use tools for storing, sharing, and telling stories with data. So, you know, evasive seems to be the phrase of the day.
Tell me what it does. It does things. It does them in a customizable and easily deployable way. And it can be adapted to meet the needs of diverse research teams.
From FieldKit lets everyone everywhere monitor the world around them with low-cost, reliable sensors and easy-to-use tools for storing, sharing, and telling stories with data, which is exactly what I read just a second ago.
Can I monitor – can I just like point this at a device in my home and it'll tell me how much power it's using or –
No,
I point it at someone and it tells me like what their age is and, you know, like can I scan myself instead of going to the doctor? These are questions that I need answered.
So if you dig into the app pictures that are up on Hackaday.io for the project, there's a pH sensor, a temperature sensor in the water modules. There's some data capture. There's a field kit station that is taking audio and photos. So, you know, I think they're trying to figure out what people want and then how to build upon that. The survey is actually kind of fun because when you look at the survey, you know, because again, there's like very kind of little, you know, there's not a lot of information there. But when you start digging into the survey, you get a pretty strong idea of where they're heading, like what role best describes what you do. You can choose more than one: field scientist, citizen scientist, educator, science communicator, naturalist, environmental advocate, engineer, other. So I'm going to put citizen scientist and educator because we homeschool. Next. What types of sensors are most interesting to you? Water quality, water level and flow rate, weather, air quality, acoustic, camera traps, soil humidity, seismic. And then which of these features would be more important to you, data visualization or integration with non-field kit sensors? Choose one. I'll say data visualization because I like data visualization. Which of these features would be more important to you, easy setup for non-experts or an active online community? I'll say easy setup because, you know. And
yeah, active online community sounds a lot like Linux to me. It's like, do you want it to be easy or do you want there to be a very active and very vocal online community? That can tell you you're doing everything wrong and that that's not how you do that. And you need to put this into the terminal and this is the repository you need.
Everything would be fine now, but you didn't. And you're vile, Vi user or Emacs user. And I'll say long battery life in the field over low per unit cost. Oh, my goodness. Which one of these features would be more important to you? Integration with social media feeds or research grade data? Okay, good. I finished the field. I don't know. I like it. They're certainly doing things that sound interesting.
Yes.
I've just subscribed and put myself on their list. That's actually really cool. Yeah. Eventually, we'll be a tricorder.
That's my dream. By the way, speaking of things that are interesting, Patrick, yes. Do you know who Centaur is? Centaur Technologies.
I'm feeling honest enough right now to say no. I have no idea who Centaur is. I know.
Have
what
you heard
the Centaur.
Of Via/Via? However you pronounce them. You know, remember those chipsets?
I am intimate. We go way back.
Yeah, they're like an old friend. Well, Centaur Technology is a division. It's a wholly owned subsidiary, I believe, of Via or Via. And on the 18th, they announced this brand new x86 processor design of theirs. Really? What's interesting about this is doing a little bit of digging, talking to people like Josh on our staff, who's, you know, he knows all about Centaur. He's actually, they sent him a development platform back in 2009 that he dug out for our podcast last night. One of their old dual core chip designs when it was still two cores on the same substrate together. Right. And they do some interesting things with design, but what they're doing here with their x86 license is coming out with new core. So it's a new core design, but they're adding a special AI coprocessor it's integrated into the CPU. So this is the first time there has been an x86 CPU with an AI coprocessor like this. And it's kind of fascinating because it's something that obviously no one else has. We don't know what kind of capacity for scale this company might have if this became a really interesting tool for any kind of deep learning acceleration. Would they be able to meet the demand or, you know, more conventional means of some such as like the GPU acceleration that's available and CPU acceleration? But having a dedicated coprocessor is interesting. And then what I found also rather fascinating is kind of reading into this, and someone on Twitter had actually posted this, and I looked, and right on the front page of their site, talking about their AI technology, it says the x86 microprocessor cores deliver high instructions per clock, IPC, for server class applications and support the latest x86 extensions such as AVX-512. And AVX-512 is currently exclusive to Intel. And I was kind of surprised that Centaur, through their Via x86 license, has access to the latest instructions from Intel. You would think it would be capped. And Josh would tell me, no, it's not capped up through like 2010. It's just current. So Intel has Deep Learning Boost. That's something they announced with their new W2200 series Xeons and the new X series high-end desktop parts that are coming. And when I talked to them on our call, I was kind of clarifying because I knew previously AVX-512 had been mentioned as a way to accelerate AI, and they said yes. The Deep Learning Boost was basically like the marketing name for what they're doing with AVX-512 instructions. And here comes Centaur with a new x86 design that has AVX-512. When if you look at AMD, AMD's Zen 2 architecture does not support AVX-512. So I just found that interesting that this company, with whatever license agreement they have, is able to provide all of the latest instruction sets that you would find on an Intel processor, but they're doing it themselves. And I don't know if this will be outside of any like very sort of niche markets. If they deal right. with like automation, like that sort of thing. But it's just interesting to consider. And we don't know if this is ready for manufacturing yet either. They're announcing the technology, so it could be they've taped it out. They maybe even have working prototypes, but this is not necessarily a shipping product.
Well, it's always nice to have someone else working on some type of AI processing. I mean, it's interesting, right? Because VIA has also changed its, you know, they've changed so much, and a ton of what they do right now is Internet of Things, but in terms of, say, automating factories or facilities and stuff like that. So they've certainly changed a lot in the last few years. I don't know. I'm curious. We wait, ladies and gentlemen, with bated breath, because sometimes you just have to. Steve emailed Sebastian. Just listen to your Fuma 2 review. The counter-rotating fans in the cooler likely serve to prevent laminar airflow over the cooling fins, providing better heat transfer and more noise. As far as I understand, the specific heat of air at a constant pressure won't vary noticeably with a 5-degree Fahrenheit ambient change or a 5F ambient change, but lower ambient would give a higher delta T and allow for increased thermal transfer. Question mark. Disclaimer, I'm not a thermal designer, but I did make use of air, water, floor inert cooled hardware in a previous life. I love floor inert. The chemical that loves to just scare you. And it's completely inert. It's awesome. There's nothing quite like pouring a liquid over your motherboard.
That sounds terrifying. But yeah.
It's cool. It's basically a complete it's good stuff.
I was reading this, and the one question I have is, if 5 Fahrenheit isn't a significant enough difference, my concern is that I had a 5 plus centigrade, like 5 Celsius difference, and I start to wonder how much that affects even the delta results, because the effectiveness of the cooler when it starts off cold, like if it's only 63 degrees Fahrenheit in this room versus a hot summer day when it might be 78 Fahrenheit in here, I think that some of the cooling potential of a device, just because it is physically limited, you only have so much surface area and it's already at a certain temperature, even if you're dealing with deltas, fans or heat sinks eventually reach a point where they can no longer effectively cool the CPU, especially when you're pushing them very hard with something like a 9900K.
So, I will say, I sort of assumed that you were using some sort of HVAC system to standardize the temperature of the room at like 68 or 72 degrees and then testing from there.
There's a problem with testing in a building from 1929 that consistent temperatures from one side of the house to the other on the same floor are highly questionable. I'm tweaking
things. We don't need consistent temperatures on the house. Yeah. It's time to.
No, you just need consistent temperatures in one space, but yeah.
Apparently, you need to build a thermally contained room in your house, which would be like building a thermally contained room in my Airstream. Actually, you know what you could use? A refrigerator.
Yeah. But I just need a box. And this is something that somebody else who has more time to work on just cooler reviews could do if I had a dedicated person and they came up with some sort of climate control box that was also completely like noise proof. And they could do all of the thermal and then the noise testing in there. But then the problem becomes, if you are enclosing it into a small space, then the ambient air becomes a lot more of an issue, and you could have significantly impeded the ability of that cooler to work. So you need a large enough space that the natural airflow is sort of helping to dissipate the heat in the air. Although one thing that I've done with cooler testing that I don't really ever talk about is I literally have a thermometer that gives me 0.1 centigrade. That was my criteria in looking for some home thermometer. It had to be digital so I could quickly glance at it and jot down, okay, ambient air 3 feet away from the test bed was this when I connected that test. And every single temperature reading, I subtract that current ambient measurement from that exact load temp from it. But apparently that's not enough if there's a huge variance in temperatures just from one year to the next, one situation to the next. So I would like to say that the average is about 68 degrees Fahrenheit. Average. But sometimes it's 72, sometimes it's 64, and how much does that affect things? So
we don't pay you for average, son.
I know. In fact, you don't pay me at all, Patrick.
I was waiting for the surly response to that, and I got it. Hey, what's up with the Neon Noir benchmark?
It's amazing, and you need to install it right now and run it on everything you own, and then do that again. In fact, when I was playing around with this Intel Nook the other night, I have an 8th-gen Core i7 Nook, and when I first found out it was available, I immediately downloaded it. It's free. You have to create a free account with CryEngine. You don't have to have the Crytek developer stuff. You don't have to download anything except the benchmark. It's a standalone application. So you add it to your library for free, download it, and it's just beautiful. I love that that Blade Runner look. It looks like the first Blade Runner movie, kind of. It's instead of a flying car, you have a drone. They showed this at CES. It was being rendered at CES at 4K, 30 frames per second on a Vega 56, and looked just fine. I was amazed that I was able to run it on just the integrated Intel, 630 HD graphics or whatever is in this Nook, Iris 655, actually. But, I mean, I had to run it at a really low resolution, but it was running passably, just so I could check it out before I could go down and actually play with it on the big gaming system. But it's just astonishing. Water effects and the lighting, the windows, the neon glow, the light interacting with objects. It's just a beautiful benchmark. And what's cool about it is it's totally platform agnostic. If you haven't checked out any real-time ray tracing stuff yet, you do not need an NVIDIA graphics card. This is not RTX. It'll run on NVIDIA, but it'll also run on AMD and even on Intel. So pick your resolution, choose the intensity of the ray tracing effect, and it does run on Intel CPU graphics. I can confirm that. 655, the Iris Pro graphics. But it's not a great situation. I mean, you're going to be running at 800 by 600 to get a really acceptable frame rate.
Right. But
it's just downright eerie how realistic, in the opening shot when you see glass and raindrops down the glass, and just they totally nailed those effects. And to think that this is something that could be implemented with Crytek's engine and run on any graphics card is
it's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
it's beautiful. Hey, do you remember Loon?
Loom with an M, the old LucasArts
Loon,
game.
Like Loon, the bird, no. Or the Canadian no. coin. So Loon was, it's funny. It's Alphabet owns them. We used to think of them as being Google, and the idea is you would have high altitude balloons that would sit in the stratosphere and provide internet connectivity to big chunks of the planet. Yeah,
you talked about this earlier this year. That's right.
So, who knows? You know, did I see an article? No, this is November 21, 2019. This is new stuff as of this morning.
New stuff.
So, Loon has a deal with Telefonica, and they are going to bring internet to parts of the Amazon. So, I bring this up in part because it means one of my great nightmares, which is that the entire surface of the planet is saturated, bathed, covered, unavailable to be away from the internet, is this much closer. The actual deal is the commercial agreement is with Internet Paratodos, says TechCrunch. That is, quote, also backed in part by Facebook and the Development Bank of Latin America, and they're bringing internet connectivity to remote locations in Latin America. And apparently, this is going to be parts of the Amazon rainforest in Peru starting in 2020. They still have to deal with some regulatory requirements because, of course, this is commercial deployment of high-altitude balloons, and there's some kind of wild stuff going on. What it didn't know is that Loon had worked with Telefonica back in May after an 8.0 earthquake hit Peru, and that they've been kind of working with Peru or Telefonica in Peru on several projects. The other one that I didn't realize is that Telecast, which is a Canadian company, was working to do a system for a low Earth orbit satellite constellation with Loon. So It's going to be about 200,000 people. Of the 200,000 people in this area of the Loreto region in Peru, maybe a quarter of them have something like 3G connectivity currently. So the internet continues to march in the corners of the world.
Google is doing them such a service too, because now they've brought the capability of Stadia gaming to these people in Peru by bringing the internet to these remote locations with their internet balloons. They're going to enable gaming like you've never seen it before in areas where it just wasn't possible before. And I think that's incredible, and I applaud Google for their efforts. I expect to see internet balloons floating around the sky near me and just basically enriching everybody's lives. And also providing just a beautiful backdrop. How better to enjoy nature than with a giant silver stringy balloon with a satellite-looking thing hanging off of it?
I don't think it's going to be real visible from ground level. It's
breathtaking.
I don't think you're going to be able to see it from most of the area it covers without with the naked eye.
Yeah, maybe not.
But of course,
maybe that's kind of transparent. It's an optical illusion. It looks like a cloud.
Well, it's also like 20 feet above the ground right now. You know, I mean, personally, I think it kind of looks like a man of war.
The cloud. They're making a cloud. Think about it.
Oh.
I haven't. And that's the news.
Yeah, I'm trying to like find a picture of Portuguese man of war. Facilia Fasalis. Man, I can't even pronounce the phylum name for that one. It looks like a Portuguese man of war in the sky, dropping little tentacles of internet all over its footprint. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're new to this podcast, you've been listening to This Week in Computer Hardware. We call it Twitch. You can find all the information on who we are, what it is, how to get more of it, and all the older episodes at twitch.tv/Twitch. If you've been watching the video version of this, the guy in the baseball cap is Patrick Norton. The guy with the fantastic headset and shocking red hair is Sebastian Peake, editor-in-chief of PC Purr.
Is it red?
Well,
I mean,
you're a ginger.
I refuse to accept that.
Hair which is not brown, not black, not blonde, but possibly red, but not if you ask Sebastian. I have no hair and I need a haircut, which is why the baseball cap is on. You can find more of me over
at ABXL.com. Hair and need a haircut? This doesn't make any sense.
Male pattern baldness. I'll let you look that up on the internet. Remember, what has been seen on the internet cannot be unseen, even if it's been delivered by Google or, Alphabet with their Loon network. Or Stadia, for that matter. Oh, my goodness. With that, ladies,
balloon gaming is coming, people. Balloon gaming.
I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Sebastian Peake.
And we'll see you next week on Twitch, This Week in Complaining About Stadia Hardware.
There.